The briefing is brought to you in association with the Sustainable Cities in Action Forum at Expo City Dubai. The Sustainable Cities in Action Forum at Expo City Dubai is a place for city leaders, developers, architects and designers to come together and innovate for the future of urban spaces. It's an opportunity for the Global South to convene in the Global South. It's a testbed for real-world solutions that will shape the future of people and planet. You can hear from the innovative thinkers and inspirational voices that drove the narrative at this year's edition by listening to Monocle's special episodes of The Briefing, recorded live at Expo City Dubai in March. Find and listen to the shows now at monocle.com or wherever you get your podcasts. The Sustainable Cities in Action Forum 2024. Collaborate, innovate, transform.
You're listening to The Briefing, first broadcast on the 11th of May 2021 on Monocle 24. The Briefing is brought to you in association with Novartis. Hello and welcome to The Briefing, coming to you live from Studio One here at Midori House in London. I'm Andrew Muller. Coming up on today's program.
For years, working people and middle class people, people who built this country, have been left out in the cold, struggling just to keep their heads above water. While those at the top have done very well, we're still digging out of an economic collapse.
U.S. President Joe Biden defends the recent generosity of welfare benefits in the face of worse-than-expected employment figures. Also ahead.
Hi, Andrew. I'm Monocle's senior correspondent Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and I'll be joined by our correspondent in Montevideo, Lucinda Elliott, to discuss the resurgence of coronavirus in Uruguay and the latest from Brazil, too.
Thank you, Fernando. The chief executive of Ipsos Mori, Ben Page, will be here with his semi-occasional statistical roundup, and historian Shalo Mbata will tell us all about the Zulu Kingdom's new monarch and a controversy over who should wear the crown. That's all coming up right here on The Briefing on Monocle 24. And welcome to today's edition of The Briefing with me, Andrew Muller. According to the best guesses of the US Department of Labor, there are currently 7.4 million unfilled jobs going begging in America. The juxtaposition between this and a current unemployment rate of 6.1% has, inevitably, caused the usual suspects to brandish their copies of Atlas Shrugged and declare that the jobless are work-shy idlers content to sponge off the gullible generosity of the state. In this specific instance, in the shape of the COVID-19 relief distributed by the administration of President Joe Biden. Well, I'm joined with more on this by Scott Lucas, adjunct professor at the Clinton Institute, University College, Dublin. Scott, first of all, that unemployment rate of 6.1% is worse than was anticipated, but given that it was nudging 15% a few months back, it's not that bad, is it?
No, I mean, what has happened, Andrew, is that for 1 month, which was the month of April, that the anticipated number of job recovered, which was expected to be maybe close to a million, came in at about 260,000. And everybody's got the jitters. Does this mean, in fact, that the American recovery has stalled out? No, as you put it quite well in your introduction, two things. First is that the reality is that as you were coming out of a pandemic in which the United States had one of the highest death rates, one of the highest case tolls, and on top of that, an infrastructure which has been shaken for a number of years and was damaged further by the Trump administration, it's not going to be just a single road upwards and upwards of progress. There are going to be places where there's slower than expected growth. But overall, the estimate for U.S. growth this year, which was revised last week, is for 7% this year and 5.5% next year, which is a pretty healthy recovery. The second point is the one that you also foregrounded. Rather than dealing with those realities, rather than talking about, let us say, the longer term, you get certain people, both because of the jitters and then because they think they can score political points, who say, let's blame it on the jobless. Let's blame it on the folks who don't have jobs, rather than blaming it on, for example, longer-term structural problems, because when you have any type of downturn in the economy, the easy target is the poor and those who have already suffered. So far from being $300 a week in supplementary federal benefit being generous, it's been effectively what has kept people afloat over the past few months. So the reality is that in scoring these political points, some analysts, Republican analysts, and a lot of Republican politicians prepared to sacrifice those folks who have already been damaged.
Well, according to one Bank of America analysis, a person on an average salary of $32,000 might actually be better off on benefits, at least until those current supplementary ones run out in September. But doesn't that suggest, or I mean, I'm not an economist, as any economist who's listened to me try to understand economics will confirm, but doesn't that actually rather suggest the problem is that people aren't being paid enough?
Yeah, I think that's a very good point. And how quickly politics flies. It was only a few weeks ago that the Republicans were blocking an increase in the federal minimum wage, not the overall national minimum wage, but the federal minimum wage to $15 an hour. The American minimum wage has stood at under $8 an hour for more than a decade, I think since 2009. And so if you're really talking about the idea of trying to lift people up, of trying to prevent them from being in a position of perpetual unemployment, then you pay them more. But the old mantra, Andrew, is that for some folks, to make the rich work harder, you increase what they get paid. To make the poor work harder, you pay them less.
I mean, how does Joe Biden handle this politically? Because he, like many Democrats, he has already gone some way down this road. He sort of seems to feel obliged to look like he's taking a hard line on welfare. But is he perhaps trying to nudge employers towards paying more?
Well, he's doing both. I mean, the reality is that in the short term, what Biden is saying is look, you know, you can't be on perpetual supplementary federal unemployment benefit. It is due to run out in September anyway, but you can't, you know, not take a job which is a, quote, suitable job, a suitable position. And at the same time, he's saying to companies, look, you need to make sure that you get your employees vaccinated. You need to pay them more, even though there's no statutory minimum wage. We need, in other words, to build the economy. And then beyond those immediate short-term measures, remember the big play here is that having passed the American Rescue Plan, which was kind of to keep people afloat despite the economic effects of coronavirus, that you have the administration proposing the most ambitious jobs plan since the 1930s, almost $3 trillion, the American jobs plan, almost $2 trillion in the American Families Plan. And it's those big pieces of legislation, which many Republicans are trying to block. Biden and his team are saying, we've got to get these through for the longer term health of America and for those people who are currently unemployed.
Just as a final thought, then, for those continuing to oppose a big hike, it would be in the federal minimum wage to $15 an hour, what's the political logic of that for them? I mean, presumably a lot of their voters are people on minimum wage.
Well, there is an economic logic which is put forth, let's be, you know, open here, which has been in this country, the UK as well as the US, which is that smaller businesses would find it difficult to pay perhaps the $15 an hour, and therefore you would have at those points of the economy a downturn. Now, in fact, what we've seen from countries that do pay a healthy minimum wage, that is not the case. But that's sort of the economic argument put forward. The broader political argument is this, Andrew, that for many Republicans, again, like the Senate leader, Republican leader Mitch McConnell, they're not there to work with Biden. They're not there to try to help all Americans. McConnell has said he's there to obstruct this administration. And obstructing this administration means hoping that the American economy gets worse, because you can say, hey, don't blame us. Let's blame the president, even though the real damagers and destroyers are the guys who are standing in the way.
Scott Lucas, thank you as always for joining us. You are listening to The Briefing. Here is Monocle's Carlotta Ribello with the day's other headlines.
Thanks, Andrew. The US, European Union and UK have appealed for calm after days of unrest between Israel and Palestinians. The violence escalated overnight when Palestinian militants fired rockets towards Jerusalem. In response, the Israeli military launched airstrikes against militant targets in the Gaza Strip. The World Health Organization has classified the coronavirus variant, first found in India last year, as a variant of global concern. The WHO says preliminary studies show the B.1.617 mutation spreads more easily than other variants and requires further study. It has since been found in 30 countries. Official data from China's government suggests the country's population is growing at its slowest pace in decades. The results, which form parts of China's once-a-decade census, are likely to add pressure on Beijing to boost measures for couples to have more babies and avert a population decline. And traditional radio could soon be a thing of the past in Switzerland. The federal government has decided to switch off FM broadcasting and only allow digital audio broadcasting, or DAB, from next year. You can find out much more about it by heading over to monocle.com/minutes. Those are the day's headlines. Back to you, Andrew.
Thank you, Carlotta. You are listening to The Briefing on Monocle 24. Now, more than one country has discovered that progress against COVID-19 tends not to be linear. Some places which once looked completely overwhelmed have recovered commendably. Others which once seemed barely troubled are now beleaguered. In the latter category, sadly, is Uruguay. Uruguay recorded, in the grand scheme of things, barely any cases of the virus in 2020, but a spike in recent weeks has caused one of the highest rates of infection of any country in the world right now. Well, I'm joined from Uruguay's capital, Montevideo, by Monocle's correspondent, Lucinda Elliott, and our senior correspondent, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, is with me in the studio here in London. Lucinda, first of all, where you are in Montevideo, how bad has it got and how quickly?
Well, bad. I mean, cases have gone from just 200 per 100,000 people in February to over 1,300. And last year, as you say, Uruguay recorded only a total of 200 deaths ahead of the Christmas holiday. It never had an official lockdown. And this weekend, that death toll surpassed 3,000. So for a country as small as Uruguay, it is a health crisis. Hospital ICUs are filling up. They've not reached capacity, but they're hovering at about 70%. And having spoken to doctors this week, you know, they're exhausted and worried as we head into the southern hemisphere winter.
Does anybody know why this has happened? Whether it is just winter doing what winter does for any coronavirus? Might complacency overhanging from last year have been a factor?
Well, most specialists actually say it is partly to do with this new, more contagious P1 variant from neighbouring Brazil. The other side of the coin is that Uruguayans themselves generally have let their guard down since the start of the year. So cases were picking up as the Southern Hemisphere summer set in around January. And with Uruguay having a pretty impressive record, plus news of the vaccines arriving, people started to get together. And here we are 4 months on, and hospitals are overloaded, mainly with people who are suffering from the Brazil variant.
Well, Fernando, on the subject of the Brazil variant, that is, of course, your home country we're talking about there. And we have spoken about the march of COVID-19 in Brazil many times before. Is there any sign of it improving in Brazil? Because when we've talked about this before, we've talked about the fact that obviously if Brazil has a problem with this, then South America has a problem with this, Uruguay being just one of nine countries with land borders with Brazil.
It's hard for me to say that it is improving. I mean, but it's definitely not in its worst period. The average number of deaths in the last 7 days is 2,087. It's still very, very high number. But I mean, we were reaching days where more than 4,000 people were dying a day. It's still very patchy, I would say, Andrew. But the interesting thing here is that the vaccine rollout, when there are vaccines, it does work. I was looking at some statistics. The number of over 60s in Brazil, the death rate for this age group dropped dramatically. So in fact, there's a lot of people in hospital that are dying. They're a bit younger. They're in their 50s, they're in their 40s, because the vaccine rollout didn't reach those age groups. So it's just a question for it to be a bit faster. Brazil is not the worst country in the region. In terms of vaccination, around 22% of people had at least one dose of the vaccine. But there's a lot of stories here about delays of kind of products from China. It's not going as fast as it should. And it's a shame, because I think we spoke before that Brazil used to be very good when it comes to mass vaccination. It's not quite happening. It's not the worst in South America, but definitely not the best as well.
Listen, to where you are, is there any sense of Brazil, and I guess specifically we should restrict this to Brazil's government and its combustible president, Jair Bolsonaro, of Brazil being blamed for any of this?
Well, I actually decided to speak to the former Uruguayan mayor of a border town with Brazil, which is called Rio Branco, this week. And it's linked by a bridge across a major river to the Brazilian city of Jaguarão. Now, officials had said that there was a massive border closure. This was in March of 2020. But he told me that on average, 85 trucks drive through every day to Uruguay from that particular crossing, as trade between the two nations never stopped. Only travel for tourism and some business was banned back in March. And so those trucks he described have traveled for miles through goodness knows how many Brazilian towns, go direct to the capital, Montevideo, where I am, to offload their goods. And he's convinced that this new strain of the virus is being spread further because of this, and that there are dozens of crossings like Rio Branco's along a 660-mile border with Brazil. So it's not just Bolsonaro, it's also on the Uruguayan side of not necessarily, you know, going all the way and closing everything down.
Just a final quick thought on this from you, Fernando. You were talking about Brazil's generally good record in vaccine rollouts. Is vaccine hesitancy a factor in Brazil at all this time?
Actually, I don't think so. I mean, there was an experiment in a small town in the state of São Paulo. 98% of the population actually accepted the vaccine. It's funny because our president himself, he hasn't been vaccinated yet, or he doesn't want to be seen that he took the vaccine, but I generally don't think that's an issue. I'm sure there are a few Brazilians who will not take the vaccine, but I don't think that's the problem. The main problem here is the slow rollout of the vaccine, which is causing so much trouble here.
Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Lucinda Elliott, thank you both. You are listening to The Briefing on Monocle 24.
Novartis is proud to partner The Briefing on Monocle 24. Novartis is a company that is committed to reimagining medicine. A global healthcare leader intent on changing the practice of medicine, Novartis has been exploring uncharted frontiers in science for more than a century. Vas Narasimhan, MD, has been CEO of Novartis since 2018. Since taking that role, Dr. Narasimhan has led a strategic and cultural transformation to build a leading medicines company, globally powered by advanced therapy platforms and data science. Under his leadership, the company has completed over $70 billion in strategic transactions. During and after his medical studies, Dr. Narasimhan worked extensively on a range of public health issues in low and middle income countries, and he continues to champion global health priorities. The global pandemic has understandably dominated the agenda and the discourse over the past year. But if we delve deeper behind the headlines, Vas Narasimhan, what kind of role has Novartis played?
For us as a company, what I reflect on is last year, despite a pandemic, we still delivered 70 billion doses of medicine to nearly 800 million people in spite of the global disruptions that we saw. And what, of course, is quietly happening behind the headlines is what we call a syndemic. You know, we see that in many therapeutic areas that patients have put off care for cancer, for cardiovascular disease, for rheumatological illnesses. And tackling that is so incredibly important for the post-pandemic world because that surge of patients is still there. And, you know, our company has been really focused on tackling that challenge. Of course, supporting the pandemic response with our manufacturing capacity, with our own drug development efforts, with our partnership with the Zurich-based company and Molecular Partners. When I reflect on it, I'm just very proud that our associates around the world were able to keep that machine running. So somehow patients still got the medicines that they needed.
Vas Narasimhan, Novartis, reimagining medicine.
You are back with The Briefing on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Muller. It's time now for one of our occasional reviews of the week in statistics, and I am joined to do exactly that by Ben Page, Chief Executive of Ipsos Mori. Ben, we have spent much of the last few days trying to figure out what we learned from last week's elections here in the UK. Is one of the things we learned that the Labour Party, the sentinel of the working class, is now in fact the party of the middle class?
Yes, I mean, it's confirmed a pattern that we saw that's been becoming clearer since 2016, when large numbers of traditional working class Labour voters went and voted for Leave, which was, of course, championed by the Conservative Party. In the 2019 general election, that pattern held. And the latest results show that places like Hartlepool, which is one of the poorest places in England, is now voting for a party led by an old Etonian run by public schoolboys, putting it a bit crudely. It's almost everything's inverted in British politics. It used to be that if you were working class, you voted Labour, and if you were middle class, you voted Conservative. Now, if you're old and working class, you almost certainly vote Conservative. And
if you're young and middle class, you almost certainly vote Labour.
If you look at the numbers on that, does this strike you as a blip or a trend?
I think it's a trend. I mean, it's what it seems to, and it's consistent with some of the challenges facing the left around the world, or social democrats around the world, which is that economics and people's economic interests at the moment seem to be trumped by their cultural interests, at least in the West. So people vote for the party that feels right, even if they don't necessarily always deliver the things that economically you would expect people on lower incomes to vote for. But it's a complex pattern, because in London, you know, these urban diverse centres, you know, you see that there, you know, same in America, the Democrats are strong, Labour is very strong in London, Manchester, etc. But it's these small towns where traditional working class voters appear to be leaving Labour.
Moving seamlessly along from the working class to the home working class, that is a cohort that a great many people have involuntarily joined in the last year. And you've been studying what people think about working from their kitchen table.
I mean, broadly, people generally, particularly in Western Europe, have been positive about it and don't want to go back to the old 5 days a week commuting to sit in an office. I mean, we need to be careful here, because, of course, we're talking about knowledge workers and administrative workers who are able to work at home. And there are a great many people who've just continued going into work in factories, shops, warehouses throughout the pandemic. But overall, you can see, you know, only 1 in 10 people want to be in an office every single day who were in an office before. We've got people who, bosses telling us, chief executives of major companies across Europe, talking about getting rid of 1 in 5 of their offices, which is a lot of empty space to be repurposed. And I'm sure Monocle magazine will be writing about this in, you know, in due course. So it looks like a hybrid mixture of home and work. Working at home, working in an office is going to become much, much more normal. Need to be careful about making predictions in a pandemic, but that's certainly the pattern. It's not true everywhere. Places like Turkey, 3/4 of people who found themselves isolated at home said they just didn't have the right equipment to do it. Whereas in contrast, places like Britain, Holland, America, you know, generally the pivot was pretty spontaneous and pretty relatively pain-free.
Finally, and very briefly, if you would, you've also been running the numbers on attitudes to climate change.
Yeah, I mean, broadly, this is we've got COP26 in Glasgow in the UK this year. Another heave on trying to get carbon reduction underway. What it's showing is that it is one of the few things that the world agrees on, that we have a clear and present danger on climate change. And the world is also pretty much agreed that their governments have not got their ducks in a row, to use a colloquial expression. Only about 4 in 10 people globally think their government has a proper plan. So a big wake-up call to world leaders, do something on this. Public concern globally continues to rise.
Ben Page at Ipsos Mori, thank you as always for joining us. You are listening to The Briefing on Monocle 24. You're listening to The Briefing with me, Andrew Muller. Regulars at pub quizzes will be aware that there are 3 remaining monarchies in Africa, Lesotho, Eswatini and Morocco. These are very far, however, from being Africa's only royal families. One of the more prominent is the Zulu royal family of South Africa, which has recently been struggling through a succession crisis and a family feud. King Goodwill Zwelithini, who had occupied the Zulu throne since 1968, died of COVID-19 in March, aged 72. The most powerful of his 6 wives, Queen Regent Matnamfombi Dlamini, died in April. The throne has now passed to their son, 46-year-old Prince MisuZulu, but not quite everybody is joining in the cries of long live the king. Well, joining me with more on this is the Zulu royal historian Shalo Mbata of the University of Zululand. We'll come to the current succession crisis presently, but beforehand, what's the best way to explain what role the Zulu royal family occupies in South Africa now?
You know, South Africa is the only country in Africa at the moment whose monarchy is recognized by the constitution. And even for non-Zulus, they recognize the Zulu royal family as the ultimate Zulu, you know, royal family. And it is the, you know, the cornerstone for a lot of people, even non-Zulus. They recognize them as the last line of defense, I guess, when it comes to, you know, traditional things.
What kind of influence does the King of the Zulus usually have? What does the role actually involve?
He is the custodian of everything Zulu, the traditions and the heritage. For instance, during apartheid, which was overcome in 1994, the black people, especially the Zulu, were not allowed to exercise their culture. So what the Zulu King managed to do during the discussions for democracy was to ensure that the Zulu nation and the Zulu monarchy is the only one that's recognized by the constitution and protected by the constitution, one. And secondly, the Zulu are the only people who managed to secure over 3 million hectares of land that is protected by His Majesty. As you can know, in South Africa, the land issue is very contentious. It's an evolving story. Black people still don't have their land that they should be controlling and having. But the Zulu managed, in the inception of democracy, to secure 3 million hectares. So a lot of people look at the Zulu royal family, like I'm saying, as the last line of defense, and they get the marching orders. Whatever the Zulu family does, the rest of the other kingdoms in South Africa follow.
So it must have been a moment of extraordinary difficulty and sorrow for Zulu people when the king died after so long on the throne. What kind of ceremony attends the passing of a Zulu king?
Well, first and foremost, he became king. He was coronated in 1973. His father is the one who died in 1968. It was shocking when he died. However, I always say to people, there was never going to be a good day for His Majesty to transcend, because in the Zulu culture, you don't die. You just move into another being, to another state, And we say, he's transcended. There was never going to be a good day. He's had a long life. He's the longest reigning king in the Zulu, a royal family. And it's not only the South African Zulus who are upset. The Zulu are spread out throughout the continent. We've got Zulus in Malawi, in Kenya, in Uganda, in Zimbabwe, Mozambique. So there are very, very many Zulus all over the continent. And when he was interred, they all came down to come and show their respects to their king. And yes, everybody, there was a joke going around in South Africa that if you're not Zulu, some people say they're professionally Zulus now. Because they recognize that it's a major thing that happened, so it was very, very sad.
So where is the succession crisis now and what was the reason for it? Why wasn't it as simple as the next in line merely stepping up to take the place of the departed king?
I think it's human nature that happened. Because the king had reigned for so long, and I guess the sons from the other queens, everybody was eyeing the throne. And when he passed, His Majesty put a regent, appointed a regent, did not appoint, the next king. That complicated matters. What is worse was that the person that His Majesty had appointed is not South African. She comes from Swaziland. She's a princess from Swaziland. So the Zulus are very inward looking like that. They felt, no, we cannot be having somebody from Swaziland to be regent, not that she was a female wasn't the problem. The issue was that she's not South African. They were worried that it might have other consequences. But unfortunately, she was hardly a month in the acting. She then passed. And then she then left her son, Prince Misi Zulu, to be king, who's now king of the Zulu, because the Zulu traditional processes have taken place. We're now just waiting for the official government installation to happen.
Well, just finally then, as you say, Prince Misi Zulu, who is one of at least, I think, 28 children that the king is known to have had, is currently king of the Zulus. Is there any doubt at all about whether that formal installation will take place? Are there rivals trying to beat him to it?
Oh, no. It's a done deal. Everybody is now calling him, Bayete. He's fully in charge. As we speak, they're sitting in a meeting, preparing for the coronation. He's putting his court together And I'm personally excited because they're young. It's his team, I call it his team, but it's his, you know, royal court. They're very young, they're highly educated. Some of them have been educated all over the world. So they're forward looking and raring to go. He's also getting married very soon. We're going to have a very beautiful queen very soon, you know, so the Zulu in South Africa is looking forward to the big day. But no, all the matters of going to court and issues like that, that's all in the past. You know, we should have a chat when the coronation happens or when the wedding happens. We're looking forward to that.
Shalo Mbata at the University of Zululand, thank you very much for joining us. And that is all for this edition of The Briefing. It was produced by Rhys James and Emma Searle. Our studio manager today was Louis Allen. The Briefing returns tomorrow at the same time, midday UK. That's 1300 in Johannesburg and 7 a.m. in Washington, D.C. I'm Andrew Muller. Thank you for listening.